The Jericho Network on Westwood One.
Happy New Year on Talk is Jericho. 2015 is going to be our year, your year, my year. Look out, baby, we're taking the bull by the horns, and we're getting ready to do some rocking. There's going to be some rocking January 25th in Philadelphia. Bischoff versus Pritchard. Monday Night Wars debate, it's going to be huge, and I will be there to moderate this fine event, having worked both in the WWE and in WCW. I know what I'm talking about. January 25th, 1 p.m., before the Royal Rumble, come to Dave & Buster's on Columbus Avenue in Philadelphia. Check out one of the great debate, one of the coolest things for any wrestling fan. And then you can go watch Royal Rumble afterwards live, or you can stay at Dave & Buster's and watch it there. Pritchard versus Bischoff with Jericho as the moderator. Get your tickets at rfvideo.com. You don't want to miss it, I guarantee it. And if you live in the Tampa area, this Sunday, January 4th, in Tampa, Florida, at Hamburger Mary's in Ybor City, it's Drags to Riches. Christian and myself will be there. The reunion of Vitamin C, the reunion of the Sexy Beasts. It's wrestlers, it's drag queens, drag queen bingo. It's a blast. Have you ever been before? It is so much fun. An amazing charity event benefiting Horses for Healing at Quantum Leap Farms. It's something that my wife and I believe in. We believe in this charity, and we believe you're going to have a great time. There's great prizes, raffle items, 50-50 draw, and admission is free to the public. Come on down, hang out, and spend a little money for a great charity, and come hang out with me and Christian. We'll be there. Well, you've been wondering where Christian is? You saw him on Raw a couple weeks ago. Now you're going to see him at Drags to Riches in Tampa at Hamburger Mary's January 4th at 5 p.m. Come on down and hang with us. It's going to be a great time.
We are just getting started.
The following program is a PodcastOne.com production.
He's a world champion wrestler,
best-selling author,
actor,
and lead singer of Fozzy.
Now
he's rocking the podcast world.
This
is Talk is Jericho.
Talk is Jericho.
Starring Chris Jericho.
Welcome to Talk is Jericho, the pot of thunder and rock and roll, yo. The spell you're in now will be broken by Chris Jericho. Happy New Year. 2015 is officially here. And thanks for spending part of your new year, one of the first days of 2015, with me right here on Talk is Jericho. And it's a good idea because it's Friday.
It's
the People's Podcast is here. The remedy for boredom has arrived. Let's go for a ride.
Frankin' Chicken, he's a bad mother clucker. Frankin' Chicken, bark, bark. Frankin' Chicken, he's a bad mother clucker. Frankin' Chicken, bark, bark. Frankin' Chicken, he's a bad mother clucker. Frankin' Chicken, bark, bark. Frankin' Chicken, he's a bad mother clucker. Frankin' Chicken, bark, bark.
All right, JBL, John Bradshaw Layfield, current WWE commentator, former world champion, and one of my big rivals in about 2007 and 8. Actually, he's been my rival since about 1994 when I first met him. He's here today, and what a story he's got. He got his wrestling start working in Japan and Mexico. We were toured together in both places. His second ever match was actually a main event. Wait till you hear that story. And of course, we'll talk about his time in WWE, his tag team days as the Acolytes Protection Agency, APA, with Ron Simmons. JBL also shares his thoughts on the Attitude Era, Vince Russo, working with Eddie Guerrero, and his final 23-second retirement match against Rey Mysterio. So much to talk about. And plus, I've written 3 New York Times bestsellers. I've had the same collaborator every time, Peter Thomas Fornatale. He's going to join us for a few minutes to talk all about the process of writing all 3 of my hit books and some of the fun memories he's got. He's a great guy, great lineage, so much cool stuff to talk about and for you to hear today on TIJ. But before we go any further, I need to say thanks to you for doing all your online shopping through my Amazon links. Easiest way to support the show so we can keep doing this for you for free for twice a week. Pretty sure you know where to find the Amazon links by now, but just to refresh your memory in case you're too hungover from your New Year's Eve celebration, go to podcastone.com and you click on the Keep Our Podcast Free banner at the top of the page. That doesn't really go good as a song. Then you hit the Talk Is Jericho button and a whole new world of buying possibilities open up to you. Every time you use one of my Amazon links, Amazon kicks back a couple of buckles to the show to help us cover production costs. I got links for Amazon USA, Amazon UK, Amazon Canada. A, you get all kinds of cool stuff on Amazon. New Fozzy record, Do You Want to Start a War? My new book and third New York Times bestseller with Peter Thomas Fornitale. It's the best in the world at what? I have no idea. Anything you want or need, you can buy whatever you want. You want to buy a big screen TV to watch football? You want to buy some hangover remedies? I'm sure they got that as well. You can get all this stuff on Amazon. You buy whatever you want. Won't cost you anything extra. No hidden fees, all charges. So if you happen to be doing some online shopping, do it through my Amazon links. Help out the show in the process. I want you to go to podcastone.com. You click on the Keep Our Podcast Free banner at the top of the page. You hit the Talk Is Jericho button. It's so easy. You can even bookmark it. So you get to those links very, very quickly. All right. Do that right now. Go check it out. Go have some fun on Amazon and have some fun with me on the Y2J WWE Winter Tour. Some dates with the WWE. Select dates. No television dates. Just live shows. Just house shows. Just non-televised events. I'm the anti-Rock. I'm the anti-Brock Lesnar. I'm coming to you live in the arenas. January 10th, Montgomery, 11th, Mobile, 16th, St. Louis, 17th, Las Vegas, 18th, Houston, 23rd, Trenton, 24th, East Rutherford, 31st, Edmonton. February 1st is Calgary. February 7th, Jacksonville. 8th is Canton. 14th, Tampa. 15th, Fort Myers, Florida. Madison Square Garden on the 27th. Head over to Toronto on the 28th. Buffalo on March 1st. And that is it. These are the only dates you're going to see me in the WWE for a long time. So come check it out. Come on down. Come hang out with me. You know it's going to be a great time. Nobody rocks and entertains the house like Y2J, and nobody rocks and entertains the house like Fozzy, continuing the Cinderblock Party World Tour in 2015 with the Dirty Youth. That starts March 4th in Belfast, Ireland, March 5th in Cork, March 6th in Dublin, and then we head over to England. Nottingham 7, Wolverhampton 8, Manchester 9, Glasgow, Scotland 10, London 11, Bristol 12, Exeter 13, Southampton 14, Brighton 15, over to Paris, France on March 17th, Pratteln, Switzerland on the 18th, Munich on the 19th, Mannheim on the 20th, 21st in Bochum, Germany. I want you to come check us out. Come rock with us. We got a huge fan base over in all those countries. Go to FozzyRock.com and get all your ticket information, all your VIP package information. Don't you dare miss it. It is going to rock. All right. Current WWE commentator and co-host of the John Layfield and Michael Cole Show, which you can find at iTunes, is coming up soon. But first, let's talk to Peter Thomas Fornitale, my collaborator, my friend, my bro who's helped me write three New York Times best-selling autobiographies. Let's check in with Pete now. All right, as everyone knows, there's three New York Times best-selling books that I've written. Best in the World at What I Have No Idea being the third. But I don't write these all by myself. I write them with a collaborator, not so much a co-writer, collaborator, a guy that I can go to ask his advice and to help me put things together. He's become a good friend of mine over the years. His name is Peter Thomas Fornitale, although I used to think it was Fornitale. He's with me right now. How you doing, Pete?
I'm doing very well. Doing very well. Great to be here. One of my favorite pods on all of the interwebs, and it's just a pleasure to be here talking to one of my favorite collaborators.
Well, it's funny, man, because we actually have three official New York Times best-selling books. That's pretty damn good, man.
It's incredible. I tell other authors this, and their jaws drop, and they want to hear all about it. It's a very tough game, the writing game, and I've been in it on both sides of the desk as an editor and a writer for 20 years, and these are the only instances where I've had this level of success as a writer. A couple of the books I've edited have been bestsellers, but for me to join this elite company, I am in forever in your debt for allowing me to ride your coattails.
You know, it's funny because it's not just riding of the coattails, it's the fact that
I think, and everyone who's read my books know, they're jam-packed full of pop culture references and little innuendos and little, you know, movie, TV, music, and you get almost all of them. I'm actually very impressed because you get like 98% of my little stupid little references, which is quite impressive.
I think when we had our interview of sorts, which was a phone call, you were testing me, throwing out some, you know, obscure knowledge of backup goalies from the 1960s NHL. And when I got one out of the three of them right, you told me I had the job. So it's... I'm glad that knowledge finally came to use. You occasionally get me on some of the metal stuff. I'm a music lover, but I don't know metal the way you do. So occasionally I'll ask a really embarrassing question that ends up being a pretty obvious metal reference. But I feel like, generally speaking, we have a very similar pop culture understanding.
I remember the one was Left to Die with Only Friend, Alone I Clench My Phone. You're like, is this grammatically correct? I was like, well, it's actually from Disposable Heroes by Metallica. You're like, I should have got that.
Well, the worst thing is I know that song. I just, for some reason, didn't have it, you know, Disposable Heroes. But for some reason, the synapse didn't fire. Yeah. That's a good example of a very embarrassing one that I missed.
Let me ask you a question now. We've been working together for three books, like we said. I think we first came into contact. Well, when did Lion's Tale come out? Was it 2007?
Yeah, boy, I was going to say 2006, but it was right around then.
I think it actually was published in 2007, which means we probably started working on it in 2006. So how did we come into contact? Because I remember, and how it works, I'll explain it to the people listening, is that you get, when you sign a book deal, you get a certain amount of money. Let's say you get, I don't know, $10,000. And out of that money, you then have to go hire a co-writer or a ghostwriter or whatever it is that you want to do, but you have to pay for that out of the initial advance that you get from the book company. So I remember Mark Gerald's my literary agent, and he got this deal. But how did we come across you, Pete?
Well, there's different ways it can work. Actually, Chris, what the process you just described does happen frequently, but with you is the only time it's worked out where the deal was in place and then I was approached. Usually, for me, when I'm working on a book project, I'm in place at the beginning and I help put the proposal together and do the whole dance from the beginning. In this instance, I heard about the book, actually, of all things, over a poker game.
Huh.
I was playing poker with a bunch of other publishing guys at a friend's house in Brooklyn. I guess this must have been 2005. And one of the other editors at the table knew that I did some co-writing and that I had dipped a little bit of a toe in that water. And they just asked me point blank in the middle of a hand of cards, hey, have you ever heard of Chris Jericho?
Hmm.
And of course, I went nuts and said, of course I've heard of Chris Jericho, and went through the whole litany of why your career was so special and your, I think I basically began doing my impression of you cutting a promo right there at the poker table. And fortunately, the guy was suitably impressed that I was the man to introduce you to. And that's where we had the phone interview that I referenced before, where we just sort of got on the horn. The biggest thing is to make sure that you connect with the person and that you have similar ideals of what the project is. And that's where you and I were such a good match, because I don't know how much people out there know about this process, but very often a co-writer, quote unquote, will basically turn on a tape recorder, ask maybe a couple of questions, get the subject going, mm-hmm. and then take these tapes and make a book out of it. Now, that to me, from where I sit, isn't really what I'm all about. It's not so interesting, nothing against it, but what I like to do is get involved in the creative process with somebody who's really into it, who just needs a little bit of help mm-hmm. getting their story out there in terms of the structure. And that's where you are such a joy to work with, because it's beyond a true collaboration, really, because not only we do the interviews like that, mm-hmm. and I put together a little bit of a framework, but then you're so into it, you go back in and take every sentence and craft it and make it sound exactly like you and punch up the jokes and basically do everything. It's almost like you're the talent, and you and I together are the co-producers.
Yeah.
And that's how these books come to be. But that's why they're so special, and they capture your voice so well. It's honestly, you know, yeah, I help, but it's all about how devoted you are to capturing this stuff and telling these stories and making sure it's all out there for the fans to enjoy.
I think I referenced it pretty early on because people would say, oh, is that your co-writer? And co-writer to me is somebody that's basically writing it for you. And we spoke about this right from the start. Like, listen, man, I'm writing this whole thing by myself. I need help because I've never written a book before, especially when we were doing Lion's Tale. And what it really started reminding me of right away is like a producer for a band, like on an album. In that, okay, let's say you're Bob Rock and I'm James Hetfield. I'm writing the songs. I'm coming up with the lyrics. I'm coming up with the melodies. I'm coming up with the structure. But you're helping me edit them. You're helping me rearrange them with the arrangements of the songs. I think this verse would sound better in the second. I think you need a more of a stronger of a pre-chorus here. And we're working together on this song. I'm writing it, but you're producing it. And I almost wanted to write, especially on The Best in the World, where I have some creative control, do whatever I want, is to make it, you know, produced by Peter Thomas Fornatale rather than with, you know what I mean? Because that's how I really feel, like you're a producer in a studio rather than a co-writer. That's why I like the word collaborator more than anything.
I love that produced by credit. I'd take great pride in that. I mean, I've worked on a lot of different books, and this is a very unique process, but it's one I think really works well, and not least because you and I both have these backgrounds in music.
Right.
I don't know if folks know this about me who are listening to the pod, but my dad was a disc jockey in New York from the 1960s until his untimely passing in 2012. And so I really grew up in this music milieu, really appreciating the job of a producer and, you know, what Landau brought to Born to Run and such. So
right.
For me to hear you say that, I take it as a tremendous compliment, and I think it speaks to why our process works so well together.
And it's funny because your dad, you mentioned your dad, and his name was the same as yours, just Peter Fornatale, but he was a very famous New York disc jockey. I remember Eddie Trunk was looking at the book. Maybe the second book, I always go through and talk to Eddie when my books come out. And he was like, is this Peter Fornatale, the DJ? I was like, well, no, it's his son. He's like, wow, I mean, that guy's a pretty popular, famous, kind of a cornerstone of New York radio.
Yeah, I have the pleasure of working on a couple of books about music with my dad, one about the Rolling Stones.
That's right, yeah.
And one about Woodstock. Have I sent you a copy of the Stones book yet, or is that still on my to-do list?
It's still on your to-do list.
I'll take care of that.
We saw the Stones together in Boston. But
awesome.
but yeah, I remember hearing about how influential your dad was, and maybe that's why you know so much about music now. And as people who like my books know, they're very much based in music and a lot of music talk. Which book do you find is your favorite of the three? I mean, it's kind of hard to discern which one. Is there one that stands out for you?
It's tough because they're all three of them have different elements that I like best. If I would always tell somebody to start with the first book just because I think it's great to get so much of that background and you being, you know, one of the last guys. I mean, obviously there have been some guys since who have arcs that are a little bit similar, but just the way that you had to travel around the world to learn your craft and getting little pieces of your character from here, there, and everywhere, whether it's and learning to work from and getting different elements from Japan, from Germany, from Smoky Mountain. There's something about that story that I still think you could have no idea who Chris Jericho is, and I think you could read that book, and I think you could still get a whole lot out of it because it creates a picture of you and your life and of this business that I just don't think you're going to get anywhere else. So if you forced me to pick one, I might pick that one for that reason.
Mm-hmm.
But for me personally, I love Undisputed because that's the time when I was probably the most into wrestling, and I remember all that stuff so well. And so for me, it resonates really well. And then the third book, the new book, I think in some ways is some of the best stories and covers the most interesting and well-known and best parts of your career.
Mm-hmm.
So it really, I can make a case for all three, but A Lion's Tale, there's still something very special to me about that one.
Well, and you know, we did write them as a trilogy, and that's the way I intended it to be. But it was never supposed to be. I mean, when we got the deal, I got the deal for Lion's Tale, and I brought you aboard. It was just for one book. I think people think that I signed some kind of a three-book deal, some kind of a giant, you know, machinated type of a plan. But it wasn't that way. It was just one book at a time. And book one was released, and I think we got a deal for book two very quickly. But that was never the intention. It was just, this might be the only book that I ever write, so let's make it a good one. But I also didn't want to go too far with it because I knew I had so much to write about that it was just impossible to do more than 400 pages, even just on the first 10 years of my career alone.
Yeah, can you imagine if you had to take the material in those three books and compress it into one? It wouldn't work. I mean, I think one of the things that helped was helped by dividing the books out. It allows every moment to shine in the right way to create a really free-flowing narrative. And one of the decisions I'm the absolute happiest with that we made in any of the three books was ending the first book on the first night in WWE. To me, that it was just such a payoff because the Chris we meet as a young kid, you know, with the BT, I can't get
BTWF
wrong of the Big Time Wrestling Federation now, but BTWF, to have that character who we meet be walking on that stage in Chicago, it's the perfect pinnacle, and that should be the climax of a book. That shouldn't be the key moment of act one of a book. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and people were pissed off at that. Legitimately, I remember the hearing like, you know, but you ended it right before you got to the WWE. And that was what I loved about it. You know, it's so not what you're supposed to do, but yet it's such a Jericho mentality. Like, well, you know, this is where it ends. And it sure left a big cliffhanger for when they wanted to do another book, which I'm glad they did.
Absolutely. There was plenty more story to come. But when you think about, when you got to think about each book individually, even though it's your life story, we have to think about you as a character. And for you as a literary character, there's no better climax than hitting the big time. Doesn't even matter what comes next, in a sense.
That's true.
At least not until book two.
Yeah, that's exactly right. No, that's exactly right. And it's funny because when I think about those stories, like when I got the deal to do book three in 2011 after Undisputed came out, I was like, I'll take it, obviously, because it's a great deal and I love to write, but I don't know what I'm going to write about. Like I was almost thinking for Best in the World, like, do I have enough material? But then, as you know, we start writing about it and there's too much material. I mean, there's way too much. It's just amazing to me how much quality stuff there was to write about from 2007 to 2012, basically, beginning of 2013. I couldn't believe it. It just kept flowing. There was so much stuff to talk about.
Well, one thing I think is part of that is that the fact that there are really multiple narratives here, because in the middle two books, especially as Fozzy gets up and running and all the ups and downs that happen with you in the music business. I mean, there's a time there where you're on top of the world in wrestling, but you still are very much in touch with that, the go-get'em grind mentality you need to have when you're on the way up, because you're literally doing that still in the music world.
Right.
And I think that created a couple of things. For one, it just kept the narrative momentum going. And the other thing is, as a character, I thought it kept you somebody that's very easy to root for, and you can see what you're all about, because you're not somebody who wants to just get to a certain point and say that's it. You're always working to find other outlets of creative expression and to just sort of keep things going and do great work that your fans are going to be interested in.
Do you have any favorite stories that stand out from the three books?
Oh my God, there's so many. There's so many good ones. Let me think of if there's one that's sort of emblematic of everything. I really enjoy, this one is so ridiculous, but it just, I think of it often. And it's the, gosh, you must have been working in Mexico, but you weren't working. This was a show maybe where you ended up getting noticed by Bischoff, but the idea that you were introduced by a Spanish speaking announcer as Chris Jericho. I think that's a particular favorite of mine.
Yep.
That was
and then you told me that years later, somehow Heyman had heard the story and would refer to you at, alternately as Harry Chico or Jerry Chico.
He still does. He still does. I just did Raw a couple of weeks ago, and we did a promo together, and he called me to talk about it before. He's like, Harry Chico, call me. Yeah, that was in a little flea market in Pomona, California. It was before I was even anywhere. It was 1991, I believe. And I remember the ropes were made out of garden hoses.
So it was in Pomona. It wasn't even Mexico.
No, okay. No. It was Pomona. Yeah, Chris had a Chico. That's funny, Pete. So I know you mentioned that you've had a couple other things that have been, you know, hits, quote unquote, for editing and stuff. Do you have anything coming up, other work that you're doing, some books that are coming out or anything?
I have a book that's actually, I think, qualifies as a local Brooklyn bestseller at this point. Not quite
nice.
The same thing as being a New York Times bestseller like our three books. But I have actually a cocktail book out, and there's actually a vodka featured in this cocktail book that would go great in a Yeah Boy, speaking of references from book three. But basically, in the last 10 years or so, really last 5 years, all of these little distilleries have popped up in and around the borough of Brooklyn, people making everything from vodka and rum to whiskey to vermouth to gin. You name the spirit, it's being made here in Brooklyn now. So my buddy Chris Wirtz and I got together and did this book, which basically profiles these local distillers. And then we also went to a lot of the local bars and restaurants, which are also sort of famous for doing really creative, fun, do-it-yourself cocktail things. And we feature the local spirits in the book.
Okay.
So it's this cocktail book that celebrates Brooklyn called Brooklyn Spirits. And it's been doing very well locally. Again, I don't know how the interest is nationwide, but it's been a lot of
fun
to work
hit.
On. And the research for that book was almost as fun as watching those tapes of you in Japan for the first book.
Now, this is the famous thing that I get asked, and I'm ready to do it, but I don't know where it is. The Strange Kentucky People. People want to see this online, but I remember I sent you the videotape of it, and I'm sure Lance Storm probably still has it, but do you have that videotape still, or is it gone?
I have it. At some point, I had it digitized.
Oh, you did?
There was a conversation that was eventually scotched by one of the publishers that we've dealt with. I actually got the thing on video. I don't on digital. I think at this point we'd have to re-digitize it if we were to make the bold decision to introduce it to the world. But no, it's survived several moves. It is in a prime place. I am very much protected. And when you say the word, it will see the light of day.
Well, listen, if you guys want to see Strange Kentucky People, hit us up on the Twitter at Talk is Jericho, or at I Am Jericho, or at Looms Boldly, which is Pete's Twitter. Let us know if you want to see it. If we get enough requests, Pete, we got to put it up and put it up for so the world can check out Strange Kentucky People.
I think, you know, once the people have spoken, we can get this done. Actually, I'm holding it in my hand right now.
Nice.
I wish we had video on the pod. I see it right now.
It's right there.
It's on. Let me read. You'll know exactly the author. You'll know exactly who wrote this VHS tape label when I read you the three things on this VHS Memorex 120 I hold in my hand. It's Strange Kentucky People. It's Fine Wrestling Matches. And then the third item is just Kiss.
And that sums up every book we've written, man. Hey, listen, one last thing. You mentioned this earlier, and I can't let you off the hook. You said that when you were playing poker that someone asked you if you knew who Chris Jericho was. You said, of course, and you started doing an imitation of a Chris Jericho promo. I got to hear it. Let me know. Let us hear it.
I told them, you let me work on this book, and your publisher will never, ever be the same again.
Pete, awesome to talk to you, man. You're a great guy. You're a great collaborator. And hopefully we get a chance to do some more work again on book four or five or six or whatever it may be.
I'm looking forward to the next trilogy.
All right, my friend. Talk to you soon, bud.
Later, brother.
All right, thanks to Pete. Such a funny guy. You can tell he's done a lot of radio. Very, very cool. And hopefully there will be a fourth Jericho book coming up soon. I do know what's coming up soon. That's JBL. He's going to be up right after this.
Talk is Jericho.
All right, back in Richmond, Virginia, in the bowels of the arena, it took us, I don't know, about
20 minutes to find a place where we could actually talk.
And we're not sure if this one's going to be quiet yet.
We don't know what we're going to get. But wanted to have you on. JBL, John Bradshaw Layfield here. Knowing you for 20 years, man. I was thinking about that. When did we meet? It was 20 years ago.
It was one of the junior tournaments in Japan.
Yeah.
Working for
Tenru.
Tenru. I was working there my first tour. You were doing in the tournament itself.
Yeah.
You guys were doing amazing things. And that was 20-something years ago.
20 years ago in 1994.
X-Pac was there. Yokozuna was there.
Mm-hmm.
Kim Duck was there, I believe it was.
Tiger Jeet
Singh. Tiger Jeet Singh.
No, not Tiger Jeet.
Not Tiger Jeet.
Kim Duck, what's his name? Tiger Chung Lee.
Tiger Chung Lee. That's what it was. Yeah, his real name. And a long time ago. I didn't think back then we'd be later doing something in the bowels of an arena.
Isn't
in Richmond, Virginia.
Is it funny to think about that?
I remember 20-something years later.
I remember Tiger Chung Lee. He was he worked here for a few years, and he had done 4 movies in his life. He did Red Heat, Golden Child, something with Dolph Lundgren, something with somebody else. And we had to watch those 4 movies.
Oh, my God. How many times have you seen that backdrop that Arnold Schwarzenegger gave him? He goes, watch this. I told Schwarzenegger, give me a backdrop into the snow. And he goes, and he did it. He goes, oh, that was easy.
We had to watch it every time over and over and over and over again. Yeah, 20 years ago, man. And here we are still. Because that was before you were in the WWE, too. You were just
way before,
an independent
guy. Yeah.
And now we're here in the WWE. And you've been here working for this company for...
Since December of 95. I'd worked 2 years straight in Europe for Otto Vance and Peter Villiam, and then came through, had a tryout match with Savio Vega in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania in December of 95 and got signed right after that.
Because you were always, you were a big guy, obviously, still a big guy. You start out in Texas. How did you end up, because, I mean, we have actually kind of mirrored career paths because you did Mexico, too.
That's right. I was trained with Brad Rangins up in Minnesota.
How did you end up in Minnesota?
I met a guy playing in the World Football League who had wrestled in Japan. I've never even met him since. Wrestled in Japan. He played in the World Football League. Hooked me up with Brad Rangins. Mm-hmm. So when the World Football League was over, I went to Minnesota, trained with Brad, and came back down to Texas because that's where I lived. And somebody said, hey, you trained with Brad Rangins? I said, yeah. I got a show on Wednesday at the Villa Inn, which had about 20 people in it. Friday night, I show up at the Sportatorium, and I think it was Al Madrill or Lou Madrill, one of the two.
Al Madrill, I think his name was.
One of the two, yeah. But there's also
and Lou Perez? Al Perez, Lou Perez?
Also his gimmick working brother or cousin or something. One of them didn't show.
Mm-hmm.
And so they put me literally in the main event, my second match, in the Sportatorium with Rod Price, who was the right guy. He was a great worker.
Uh-huh.
Got me through a very long match that I was not qualified to be in. And somebody was there that day from Japan. I think it was Kendo Nagasaki, Mr. Sakurada.
Right.
And he booked me in Japan after my second wrestling match.
Wow.
And I was in Japan like within a month. And Bob Orton asked me, he goes, kid, how long you been working? And I said, about 3 weeks. He goes, no, not how long you've been here. How long you been working? And I said, 3 weeks. He said, what are you doing here? I said, I don't know.
Because the business was pretty hot in Japan back then. There was like 32 promotions or something like that. There was obviously the big ones, New Japan, All Japan. But there were so many kind of independent offshoots.
Right. And that's one of the things Kendo was part of. He had, I think, NOW, I think, was it. He split with Tenru, who had split before with
All
Inoki.
Japan.
So that's how I got with Kendo. He just happened to be in Texas. He never saw me wrestle. He just saw this big kid who had been trained by Brad Rangins, who was in the main event, and booked me in Japan 3 weeks later. And I had no idea. If I'd have known now what I knew then, I probably wouldn't have gone because I was so far over my head. I mean, guys were killing me with chairs and everything in the world. I had no idea what I was doing. Bob Orton actually helped me tremendously. He would take me in the ring before the matches and show me just enough to get through the match that night. And I was over there about 3 or 4 weeks, and Bob helped me tremendously.
So you're basically training on the fly.
Completely on the fly. In Texas, in Japan, I got booked right after that to go down to Mexico. It was all just kind of a lucky thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then when Larry Cameron died in Europe, they fired all the American boys for the European tour for Otto Vance in, I believe, 94. And my picture just happened to be there. Jimmy Suzuki sees my picture. I sent all these videos, pictures, everything. Jimmy sees my picture and he goes, oh, Otto, I know him. He's a good boy. Otto goes, okay, I take him. And that's how I got my job in Japan.
Oh, you're a big guy.
So I wasn't qualified. Basically, what I'm saying is I wasn't qualified to do anything I've done. I just kept getting hired places.
Yeah.
I'm still not qualified to be here. Vince doesn't even know I do commentary. He never listens.
I didn't even know, right? But you're a big guy. You had long blonde hair at the time. And for whatever it was, the Texas gimmick always worked in Japan from Hanson, yeah, those, your Texas cowbell, because that's what you did, right?
Sure, absolutely. Yeah, and the whole thing always worked. You know, I got the privilege of working with Stan later, and it was I was in awe of Stan Hanson, of all those guys. I was in awe of the Von Erichs. I remember the first match I had with Kevin. Kevin will probably tell you this day, it was one of the worst matches he probably had ever had, but it was because I was such a fan. And, you know, I grew up watching these boys, even though he wasn't that much older than me. Mm-hmm. And I was in awe of them. And that was a real problem I had to get over with Kevin and Kerry.
Because the Von Erichs were like gods in Dallas.
Oh, my God. I traveled with Kerry some, and he was the closest thing to a rock star I've ever seen. He had just a humble disposition about him. People were attracted to him like moths to a flame. Mm-hmm. He had a charisma that was unbelievable.
And such a good-looking guy, too. I remember seeing him just on magazines. Like, he just looked like the perfect wrestling, you know.
And he carried himself the same way.
Yeah.
He just had an innate ability to be a star. I mean, some guys are just born to be a star. Kerry Von Erich was born to be a star.
What held him back? Issues? Substance?
Yeah, I think it was substance. From what I understood, in the WWE, yeah, it was substance issues that he finally had a problem with. And,
gotcha.
You know, then... he was supposed to be wrestling with us on a Friday night in the Sportatorium. I think he disappeared on a Tuesday. And I was living with Bobby Duncombe at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And Bobby got up one morning and goes, I think Kerry's killed himself. And I said, why in the world would you think that? He said, well, he's disappeared. He said he shot himself in the heart. And I said, why would you say that? And he said, because a month before he told me he was too vain to shoot himself in the head. He'd shoot himself in the heart. And sure enough, I think they found him on Wednesday or Thursday. And he had shot himself in the heart. Now, at the time, he hadn't been busted. And so I don't think he had any plans at that point of, you know, this was not a prediction of how he was going to go out. I think he was joking with Bobby, but that is how he ended up killing himself, by shooting himself in the heart.
Wow.
Talked to Kevin right before that, told him. Kevin was on his way to try to talk him out of it, because I've talked to Kevin about this a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And then Kerry shot himself sometime Wednesday or Thursday. I'm not sure when they found the body. But we were supposed to be, I don't think in a match, but we were on the same card on Friday night. A lot of people say they were supposed to wrestle with Kerry. I've heard about 100 different people say, we're wrestling with Kerry. No, you weren't.
Right.
But we really were on the same card that night in the Sportatorium. I don't think in the same match, though.
What a tragic kind of fate for that family, too. You know, I mean, growing up, like you said, in Dallas, and they were such gods and everything, and then now Kathy and Kevin's literally the only one left, you know, out of the six or seven kids that there were.
Yeah, and, you know, apparently David, you've seen the pictures of David,
yes,
at the Ribera's Steakhouse, you know, the night before he passed away. Bill Irwin was, I believe, the one that found him in his hotel there in Japan, and, you know, that was just a mistake. You know, he had a bad stomach. He probably drank a little too much, went home, and unfortunately drowned himself when he regurgitated lying on his back.
Yeah,
and that kind of set off a snowball chain with the Von Erich boys.
Yeah, it's a sad story, like you said, and kind of the end of a dynasty, but did start out a lot of guys as fans, you know, yourself. I know Steve Austin was another huge fan of those guys. But I was laughing. We talked about this briefly last week. When I started in Mexico, Vampiro Canadiense was the big star. Like, he was like the Hulk Hogan of Mexico. And you were booked as his rival as the Vampiro Americano Monterrey, Mexico.
This is a great story. I was wrestling on the border for some guy down there. Kerry Von Erich was going down there as well. So was Kevin. And somebody saw me down there and wanted me to come to Mexico. Well, of course, you know, I had no money. They were paying me, I think, $400 for the Sunday I was there for a couple shows or something. Wasn't much. But it was, I'll tell you what it was before the peso was devalued.
Right.
So I used to get 2.1 million pesos for like four nights of, say,
which you would divide by three.
Yeah, so it was $700.
Right.
But it was a stack, you know, 6 inches high. So they'd pay you before the last match. I would literally tape it to my ankles.
Yeah.
Because you couldn't, leave in the draft.
Because this was border town Mexico. So there was thieves.
This was Matamoros. Everywhere. This was Reynosa.
Yes. Monterrey was the big place.
Nuevo Laredo. And this were some bad places.
That you, like, couldn't, blood sport, like the movie Blood Sport, the chain fence around the ring.
That's right. They actually had the fans in behind the chain length. And so they brought me down to Monterrey. And when I got my first press conference, I brought all my cowboy gear with me. They said, leave that there. So I walked out there on stage, and a guy asked me, he said, why did you choose the name Vampire? And first I'd heard of it. So I turned to the guy next to me and I said, I hope you're smart to the business. I whispered in his ear. I said, I hope you're smart to the business, because I have no idea what he's talking about. So he turned and answered in Spanish. and gave this long, lengthy explanation. So when I got done, I asked the guy, I said, why didn't you tell me that this was a different character? They said, yeah, you're going to be the American vampire. I said, okay. I said, what is that? They said, well, we have a Canadian vampire. And that was the first I'd heard of it because we didn't get, you know, Mexican television up in
yeah,
Texas.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I started watching. This guy was over like Hogan huge. In the 80s.
Yes.
It was unbelievable how much this guy was over. He had everything. Well, apparently he had punched one of Elizondo's little stooges.
Mm-hmm.
And Elizondo had fallen out with him. And they brought me down somehow either to replace him or work with him. I never figured out which.
Or to stick it to him, rub it.
Yeah, I think to stick it to him. Yeah. I think is what they did.
Yeah.
So I didn't know this. I thought they brought me down to wrestle against him, lose the name, lose the title, because they put the title on me. And he was in on it. He wasn't in on it. So the first night we met was in the Plaza del Toros in Monterey.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sitting in a locker room, and I realized we've got a problem between us. And I said, dude, do we have heat? And he said, well, you're wearing my stuff. And I said, yeah, that's the idea. I'm wearing your gimmick. I'm going to lose to you. You get the whole gimmick. Then I'm going to lose the title to you. This is all a work. And he goes, no, you're wearing my stuff. I said, I'm sorry. I don't know what you're talking about. He had ordered stuff in Monterey. The office had gone down and picked it up, didn't pay for it. So I'm wearing his gear he had paid for, and he thinks I've stolen it or
something.
Wearing
his stuff.
I'm literally wearing his stuff. And I just started laughing. I said, dude, I had no idea. And he looked at me. He just relaxed. I mean, up until then, I mean, I think we were on the verge of a fight.
Yeah.
Which I had no idea I was going to be in. I didn't know there was heat. And so when he tells me that, he kind of starts laughing. He goes, you're not in on this at all, are you? I said, I'm in on nothing. I said, they won't get me more work papers. They're lying to me about taxi rides. I'm in on nothing. And after that, we worked together a ton of times.
Yeah.
I had a good time with him. You know, people have thought different things about Vampiro. He was always great to me. Mm-hmm. So that's my recollection of him. And to me, a very good guy.
Yeah.
I saw him about 6 months or a year ago, and he's a big, tall, good-looking guy. Mm-hmm. And I get on the elevator. And this guy's completely bald. He had shaved his head on purpose.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, you don't remember me, do you? And I said, I'm sorry, you look familiar. And he goes, you were wearing my stuff 20 years ago. I said, oh, my God, it's Vampiro. I said, you're the real vampire. And sure enough, it was. We had a great conversation. We always got along really well. And working with him was a pleasure. He was so over. I don't think people realize how over that guy was. Mm-hmm. Down in Mexico. He could do anything. We used to sell out the Plaza del Toros.
Yes.
At 18,000-plus people on his name alone.
I mean, and that's not wrestling exaggeration, because I was down there too. And actually, one week he hurt his leg or something, and I had to replace him in a match with Norman Smiley, Black Magic. And that place was sold out only because he was still going to be in my corner. It's still
right.
Sold out. And he had, you know, not just dolls but ice cream bars and, you know, pinball machines and condoms and balloons and whatever it was.
He even had a rock band too, dude.
Everything, yeah.
Are you sure you're not the Canadian vampire? You've got pretty much all this. You got pretty much all the same stuff.
That should have been my gig.
You just don't have the perfume vampire. You're selling on the side.
That's
and
the condoms, exactly.
And the condoms,
stuff, right? So, but you mentioned that you started very quickly, ended up in Japan, Mexico. So it wasn't too long before you got a tryout in the WWE, because you said you've been here since 95. So you started in about 92?
Started in 91 or 92. I can't remember which.
Okay, so pretty early on you had your tryout and got in.
Yeah, I went to Europe. I wrestled there 2 years, which was probably the best thing I ever did. Wrestled the whole European circuit. You know, we wrestled on the carnival grounds where you'd go and wrestle for 8 straight weeks in one place.
In the same building every night.
In the same building, which is a great learning environment, because you'd have people who paid for VIP tickets that would be there every night.
Mm-hmm.
So you might wrestle, I mean, JBL might wrestle Chris Jericho 3 times in a week, but you have the same people there every time.
That's right.
So everything's got to be different. Everything's got to be changed. And mm-hmm. you'd be there for 8 weeks. So you couldn't just go out there and do the same spots. You couldn't do the same match. You constantly had to think of new and different things to listen to the crowd. It was a great learning environment.
Who else was there when you were in
Fit
Germany?
Finley was there, who I've always said is, in my opinion, is the best heel I've ever seen. He was there for his 20th year was celebrated, I think, in 94 when I was there.
Wow.
So he's been in the business 30 years now.
That'd be 40 years if that was his 20th.
40, I'm sorry, yeah. 40. I can't add. I'm from Texas. And 40 years. That's right, because he celebrated that recently. And Fit had been the top heel there for 20 years in front of the very same people for 20 years. I mean, that to me was probably the greatest run of anybody that has ever been.
Amazing that he never turned babyface, because the best heels always turn babyface because people just start to like them.
Right. And I think it gives credit to him being a heel. You know, he was a heel 24/7. You know, back then back then everybody was their character 24/7. Yes. But he really lived that character. And I wish WCW had gotten to see him when he was at his best. You know, he got hurt shortly after he got to WCW. And he wasn't the same Finley that he was, that people saw him in Europe. In fact, when I got signed in WWE, Vince McMahon called me in and said, well, is there anybody else in Europe that I should sign? I said, no doubt about it, Dave Finley. And Vince kind of laughed. He said, well, should I sign him rather than you? And I said, if I were you, I would. And Vince just started laughing. He said, really? I said, he's that good. And he said, well, what's he doing? I said, well, I heard he's signing with WCW. And that was when Vince, if you went to WCW at all, wouldn't even talk to you.
Yeah.
He goes, okay, and just forgot about it. And never brought it up again.
Because, you know, and this is another thing. I mean, people like to glorify like the Monday Night Wars and what. It was a real war.
Oh, absolutely.
There was a war, man.
Yeah.
You know, and because I was on the WCW team, but it was like our team and your team. And if you worked one, you know what I mean? It was a real kind of a serious deal.
Yeah. I remember the time that the DX invaded you guys, were Norfolk or wherever it was.
Just down the road from here.
And I remember them telling Hunter and those guys, listen, if Haku walks out, just leave.
Vince said that?
Yeah. If Haku walks out, just leave. Look, I'm like, that's where they actually went, like nuclear bomb. Yeah. You know, that's a little too far. But that night, they weren't sure if WCW wasn't going to show up to WWE. Mm. So they told like me and Ron, the Harris Boys, Shamrock, I think Blackman was here at the time.
Yeah.
All these guys, hey, be out in the parking lot at the end. We don't know for sure if there's not going to be a Anchorman gang fight.
Yeah.
So literally, me and Ron, along with probably, you know, we had big guys back then, probably 17, 18 different guys, including Ken Shamrock, which is really the only one you needed.
Yeah.
We're all standing around while Vince left just because we didn't know if maybe WCW is going to return the favor and, you know, come and storm us. We had no idea.
Where were you guys at if we were in Norfolk?
Norfolk or whatever the closest that place that is close to that. There's a Norfolk. There's a place right across the
okay,
water.
So there would be like there. A yeah. Okay, gotcha. That so it's fairly like Hampton or whatever
Hampton.
It was, something like that.
I think it's Hampton.
Yeah. So
whatever it was, we were about 20 minutes apart. I believe is what it was, something like that. You know, those two towns, and we had no idea. And that's when Vince famously told Hunter. He said, "What happens if Eric Bischoff shows up?" He said, "Well, put him in our ring." He said, "Who are they going to watch? They're going to watch WCW with nobody in it. They're going to watch Eric Bischoff and me fight."
That's right.
And Vince literally gave him the green light. If they show up, show them in.
I remember that night too. Somebody, it might have been Arn or Flair or something, was like, open the door. Let him in. See what happens now.
Right.
But there was still kind of like, oh, we can't, we might get sued or whatever it was. But yeah, that was legitimately a war.
Yeah, like legitimately. Said, you know? I remember the time that you guys were preempted. We did an 8.1 rating that night. You guys were preempted for NBA or something like that.
Yeah.
You know, back then, we were both doing 4s, 5s, and 6s at the same time.
Yes. Which is a combination of like 10 million or 12 million wrestling fans.
It was unbelievable.
Yeah.
You know, now you do a 3 or 4, people, oh, that's great.
Mm-hmm.
Back then, if you did a 3 or 4, somebody would get fired. You know, but it was a different time. I understand that, but it was a different time. I remember Sunday Night Heat one time, our Sunday show did a 4.
Wow, you know, think about that.
That's unheard of.
An hour-long show, I think it was on MTV, I believe it was, or something like that.
I think that's right,
yeah. Small network doing a 4 rating.
And we did an 8 that one night when you guys were preempted, right at the very peak of it.
Yeah.
You guys had a baseball or basketball game, something preempted you guys.
And we would always,
all the fans came to watch us that one night.
And it would be the same for us when you guys had the Westminster Dog Show.
The Westminster Dog Show, the dumbest thing in the world.
How crazy was that?
You know, they actually... They paid a fortune for that because they got huge advertisers because they figured it
very
was a
ritzy
high,
crowd,
a ritzy clientele.
Yeah, Raw would be preempted in the middle of the Monday Night Wars. Once
Billy Gunn bought a dog one time for the Westminster Dog Show.
What do you mean?
So he comes in and he wants to buy his kids a dog. You know, Billy's a really good father. He always had his boys around. And he said, and so he tells the lady, he says, I'd like to buy a championship dog. And so she says, okay. And I think the number was 5 or something like that. And he said, well, how much do you want for it? She said 5. So he comes up and tells us. I said, Billy, you paid $5,000 for a dog? I said, that's outrageous. What if the dog dies? You just lost $5,000. We weren't making that much money.
Yeah.
So he calls the lady up and he says, listen, I think I paid too much. She says, well, I don't know. I've never sold a dog before. She goes, you just seem like a nice guy. She says, if 500 is too much, she goes, he had agreed to pay $5,000 and all she wanted was 500.
So that's why wrestlers shouldn't buy show
that's
dogs.
That's right. It was exactly. 5 or 8 or some number, but he mistook hundreds to thousands. Yeah, so wrestlers should not negotiate their own contracts.
Ever, right.
Ever.
Yes.
Especially if you're Billy Gunn. He only had 2 words to say, and he got them wrong most of the time. That's what I always say about him. Right. Yeah.
You came in, you were doing the, did you come in as the new Blackjacks?
No, I came in as Justin Hawk Bradshaw. I had been John Hawk. My first match, there was an Ethan Hawk there. We looked a lot alike. I never saw this guy again. And Killer Tim Brooks says, I'm going to name you John Hawk, his brother.
Because Ethan Hawk's an actor.
Correct.
Okay.
But at that time, I don't know if he stole the name from the actor, or if the actor was, you know, this was 20-something years ago. And so Killer Tim Brooks named me John Hawk. So I used that name throughout my career until I got to WWE. And then Vince wanted to name me Justin Bradshaw. And I have no idea why. I think probably Terry Bradshaw, the commentator, is a country-sounding name. And I said, well, how about Justin Hawk? Because I never dreamed I'd be here more than 2 or 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
I figured I'd wrestle here a while, go back to Japan, and finish my career.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought Justin Hawk is close enough to John Hawk.
Smart.
That I could take that name and go back to Japan. And so I don't know if Vince sensed what I was doing or not, but he gave me the name Justin Hawk Bradshaw, which killed me for autographs because now I've got to sign this.
JHB.
So that's how I got the whole name of Justin Hawk Bradshaw.
And when you first came back in those days, there was really no guaranteed contracts at that time.
None. I signed a deal. I think it was 10 appearances for $150 appearance.
That was the contract.
That was the contract. 10 appearances for the year. $150. It was $1,500.
Wow.
Because DDP had called me from WCW and said that they wanted to sign me. And so I got home and told my dad. I just gotten back from Europe after 2 years. And he said, what have you done? I said, well, WCW has offered me a guaranteed contract, and WWE's offered me $1,500 for the year. He goes, which one'd you take? I said, WWE, of course. He goes, shrewd, real shrewd. But no one had a contract. I mean, even Hogan and them, they had basically nothing.
The rumor was Vince said, I'm offering you an opportunity.
That's right.
You to an opportunity.
Yeah, and I never had a high upside anyway, even when we had guaranteed contracts. Mm-hmm. And I just always thought that if you earned it, you should get it. So it never mattered to me what the...
And you would make your money based on where you were on the card. If you were open match or if you were on a pay-per-view or whatever it was, you'd get paid accordingly.
Apparently Stone Cold had a very low downside, which people would be surprised about. And he probably made 10 or 15 times that downside.
Of $1,500?
Of $1,500, at that rate, he's making 15 grand a year. Mark Merrill was the first guaranteed contract. It was the first one to come in. We got Mark. Everybody thought he was going to be the guy. And they gave him the first guaranteed contract to Mark Merrill.
And once again, that's because of the war. Because there was a bidding war had started, and they didn't want to lose out.
And we got him, and he was just useless to us.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know what happened in WCW that he got over like he did.
It was just the gimmick. That Johnny B. Badd thing just struck a chord. You know?
It never worked up here.
Mm-hmm. So was it kind of like once he signed a guaranteed contract, did everyone else get guaranteed contracts afterwards?
After that, that's when it started. Yeah, when Brett first left. You know what? Brett may have actually been the first big money contract. Mm-hmm. I can't remember. Maybe Brett was the first big one, and Mark Merrill was the first to come in with a contract. Because Brett, got a pretty big contract at the time. And then I remember when Brett jumped, I was talking to Jack Lanza. I said, oh, my God, what are we going to do? I'd never seen a big name leave a company.
Mm-hmm.
He goes, Hogan left, Warrior left. We'll figure it out.
Yeah.
You know, and there wasn't that much panic. And then Diesel left and Razor left, which, I mean, now all of a sudden you've got a huge void. Those were our top guys.
Yeah, all leaving at once.
All leaving at once. Mm-hmm. And we weren't getting many people back. And it looked pretty bad at one point. I mean, we were getting killed by WCW for a long time.
I remember at that point in time, our main events in WCW were really bad in the ring, but they were built well.
Yeah.
But it was the undercard that kind of really saved the day. Like guys, the smaller guys and the guys that could put on a show, because the guys on top weren't putting on a match. WWE was kind of opposite. The guys on top were like, you only had a few guys, but you had Shawn and Brett, and that was basically all you needed for a good chunk of that time.
Because
they were so good, better than anybody that WCW had. So even though the undercard in WWE wasn't as strong, the main events were killing it.
Yeah, and I've always said the exact same thing was the difference. Was, you know, your top guys were at the time older and had a few more injuries.
That's right.
And couldn't have the long, lengthy matches. You know, Hogan was, a few years past his prime and couldn't do a 30-minute match anymore.
even though he thought he could. Yeah.
Our guys at the time, you know, especially when Stone Cold and The Rock came into it.
That's
and
right.
Then you add Triple H. You mm-hmm. got Shawn. I mean, we got guys that can go for an hour.
Right.
And they did that every night in the house shows.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was incredible the amount of talent we had on top, how good they were in the ring.
Yeah.
And that's what I thought was the real difference was. You guys had great matches, but underneath those top guys.
Yes.
And unfortunately, to me, it wasn't necessarily a discredit of the top guys. Most of those guys at that point had been injured and just couldn't put out the 30 to 40-minute matches anymore.
They were getting by on the old-school mentality of wrestling where it's about the name and the angle, and then the match is what it is. We've got your money already, you know, kid. But another thing, too, I remember when I first got to the WWE was just how big – I mean, that was a crazy time, like the Attitude Era – talking about live events, we would go, you and I included, from Chicago to Detroit to St. Louis to Dallas. That would be the loop. And every place would be sold out, 15,000 people for a live event, for a house show.
Yeah, it was an unbelievable
amazing
time.
Right?
Yeah, we went from not being able. I remember one time we worked Reunion Arena in Dallas, the old Mavericks Arena before they built the new AA Arena. And we drew less than 800 people. And I remember saying, talking to someone, should we go to the Sportatorium to wrestle? And there was a lot of debate there at that time because we couldn't justify the expense of being in Reunion Arena.
Yeah.
And I said, it just looks bad going into the Sportatorium. And so we stayed in the big arenas, but we couldn't give away tickets at the time.
Same thing in the Garden, too, right?
That's right. So I remember the first $100,000 match we had was in the Meadowlands. We did 108, and the whole company jumped up and down.
Wow.
Can you imagine that?
108,000 in the Meadowlands.
And it was a landmark moment for us. It was the first 100 grand crowd I'd ever seen, and a lot of the guys had ever seen.
Put that in perspective, that'd be about 3,000 to 4,000 people.
Right.
Basically, in an 18,000-seat arena.
In an 18,000-seat arena, which looks remarkably empty. I remember we were in Orlando, same thing. That's a huge arena there, and it was just a pittance of people that were there. And then you go fast forward, then all of a sudden Diesel and Razor and Brett jump. They jump start the NWO angle, and then Stone Cold and The Rock get incredibly hot.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden now, every arena we went to was sold out. Every arena. I mean, it was anything you put Stone Cold's name on, we sold out.
And conversely, everybody else on the show had an angle and a character and a gimmick. Everybody was over.
We had an incredible deep roster.
Yeah.
As did WCW.
Sure, but in WCW, they never gave us as much time. Like, we would get over because of our work. I don't think I ever did a promo in WCW, maybe one or two. But, you know, we're talking about how you came in. You started with the new Blackjacks and kind of floundered for a bit. And then suddenly, they put you together with Ron Simmons and the APA. The what does that stand for again? The
Acolyte Protection Agency.
Yeah, because you were the Acolytes, which was an offshoot of the ministry.
That's right.
And then kind of become this protection agency, which was one of the best gimmicks on the show. And you guys were third or fourth on the card.
That's right.
Still one of this amazing gimmick.
Yeah, and we'll come out to a good reaction.
Yeah.
And, you know, sell quite a few t-shirts because we were a characters.
Yes.
But everybody above us came out to maybe a better reaction or just as good at least. Then the main event, of course, was off the charts. You had Stone Cold and The Rock or whoever doing their stuff. I mean, it was an incredible time of incredible depth that we had. I think that was probably the deepest roster of all time.
It's like a good football team or a good hockey team. You have the stars, but to win the championship, everybody has to play their part exceptionally.
Right.
And that's what I found about that time. Everybody, whether you're first match or last match, did exactly what they needed to do for the team to win.
Yeah, and you know, it was such a fun time because it was all hands on deck.
Yeah.
Remember, Howard Finkel would sit back and watch WCW Nitro and report to Vince about
what was going on
there. When were they at commercial break? When were they not at commercial break? You know, we do the same thing now on our show. If there's a big Monday Night Football game, we know when they go to halftime, and we reset the show at that point.
Mm-hmm.
Michael Cole will come on. If you wonder why he runs down the lineup of the show, it's because something else is happening in competition programming.
I gotcha.
So, you know, you'll hear somebody in your ear say, hey guys, we got the whole audience. And all of a sudden we'll now say, oh, what happened tonight was Chris Jericho and Bray Wyatt or Randy Orton and Kane, and then you reset the entire show.
Gotcha.
So we still do something similar, but before it was WCW Nitro.
Yeah. Right. I remember they used to jump up and down if our pyro went off. Nitro's pyro went off before Raw's. They'd be like, oh, our pyro went off a minute earlier. Stick it to him. Like, what? So how did you and Ron end up getting put together, though, as a team?
Ron and I were just good friends. And me, him, and Godfather rode together for a while before we ever became tag team partners. And Vince saw us one time in a bar on my birthday. sitting there laughing and talking, just me and Ron. And he brought me in the next day. It was in Baltimore. It was the day after my birthday. And he brought me in the next day, and he said, I want to put that on television. And I said, put what on television? You know, well, you know, when your boss catches you drinking, you know, you wonder if you're in trouble. Yeah. And he goes, you and Ron. He goes, sitting around drinking, talking, BSing. He goes, I love that.
Hmm.
And I said, you really want to put that on television? So I tell Ron. Ron says, we're going to drink beer on TV. And I said, yes. He goes, I love it. And so that's what they did. They came up with the APA Protection Agency. I remember we had the door there,
mm-hmm.
and Ron was the one that told him, just leave the door. They said, well, there's no walls. He goes, that's perfect. Leave the door. That was Ron's idea.
And you had to walk in
through the door. Had to walk through the door, yeah.
You tried to walk around, but oh!
Yeah. There's the door. Locked myself out one time.
Yeah. I remember you guys would play cards, like you said. I remember one time, did you win Howard Finkel in a bet?
We won Howard Finkel in a bet. That's right. Yes, we did. It's the worst bet we've ever won.
I remember even more than that, though. This is how crazy it used to be, is that the finish of the whole thing was supposed to you would be in the shower with Howard.
Not in the shower, in the locker room.
In the locker room. It would be inferred that you were going to...
The old deliverance scene. That's right. Yeah. And we did it. I mean, Howard, they told us about it earlier in the day. I mean, this was the Attitude Era.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
anything went.
This was not even out of the ordinary.
Yeah.
And I said, Ron said, what are we doing? I said, we're doing some deliverance scene with Howard. Probably use a little more colorful language than that. And he goes, okay, fine. And that was it. So Howard was upset about this all day. He was crying on and off all day. Called his wife. His wife called the office.
His wife called Linda.
That's the rumor that I heard as well. And so Vince goes, Howard goes, Howard, shouldn't Bradshaw's wife be the one griping about this? He's the one doing it. So he causes us to lose the match. And the last scene you see is us pouring baby oil on Howard, telling him to get ready to squeal like a pig. And here's the bad part. We thought it would make us heels. We walked out the next week and people popped. I'm like, you are the sickest people I've ever seen. So, yeah, this was a whole long drama-filled day of Howard Finkel trying to get out of this.
Yeah.
And me and Ron could have cared less.
Yeah, and Vince, too. I think the only reason why there was any kind of reprieve is that Linda got a call from Howard's wife and then called Vince and said, Vince, you stop it right now.
That is okay, what I heard, yes.
Sorry. But, I mean, that was the times, like you said, that attitude. I remember going to the ring with a kid with the Steve Austin foam finger, 8 years old, telling me to F off and not using F, the whole word. And his dad standing behind him going, yeah.
Yeah.
Like, how could you let kids talk like this?
And I remember this. I mean, you know, people are going to take that story out of context, put it in a PG era. It sounds nuts, but that wasn't nuts. I remember one time X-Pac comes back and he asked Vince Russo, he said, do we have a delay? And he goes, yeah. He used GD and he didn't say GD. He's said the whole word out. Nobody had a problem with it.
Yeah.
And I'm going, wait a minute. Shouldn't somebody say something about that? But that's how it was back then.
That was the time. That was the defining moment of that era. How important was, or unimportant in your opinion, was Vince Russo to the whole mix?
You know, I don't know. Me and Ron didn't get along with Russo. He didn't like us. Me and Barry didn't get along with Russo. But in fairness, he probably didn't get along with us either. I don't know, because, you know, he went down to WCW and did not have a lot of success. And I've read some of the stuff he's written since that, you know, there's probably reasons he didn't.
Mm-hmm.
But everything ran through Vince
as
a filter anyway. So whether you had Brian Gewirtz or whether you had Vince Russo or you had Ed Koski, whoever it is, it all runs through Vince in the end. So it's hard to answer how much success Vince had, because when he went to WCW, he didn't have that success.
Mm-hmm.
Now, maybe the structure was against him. I don't know that because I wasn't there.
Sure.
If you read what he wrote, it was. And I don't doubt that. Mm-hmm. I have no reason to think that he's telling anything but the truth.
Right.
So I don't know how much goes to Vince and Ed Ferrara and Vince Russo. And how much just it was just a sign of the times.
Well, like you
said, I think Stone Cold was going to happen anyway. I think The Rock was going to happen anyway. I think a lot of that was just was a moment in time that maybe he helped it, and maybe he put a little more fuel in the fire. But I'm not sure he created it.
Well, when you have characters like Steve Austin, the guy, and, you know, Dwayne Johnson, the guy, and then, of course, the X Factor, Vince McMahon, like you said, that would have happened either way. And you mentioned earlier kind of similar story. I remember when Russo left to go to WCW from here, they never really said anything. They never had a meeting or never really told anything. And I thought, like, wow, Russo's gone. I remember going to Pat Patterson, like, Russo's gone. He goes, yeah, no big deal. They come and they go. It doesn't matter. As long as Vince here, we're okay. And that's basically it. You know?
Believe me, that was the mindset the whole time.
Yeah.
I mean, when Diesel and Razor and Brett all left together, I thought, my God, I've jumped on a sinking ship. Uh-huh. You know, I'd never seen big stars leave a company. It was not a big deal to Vince. I think Vince almost likes when stuff goes wrong because he buckles down, he bows up, and he starts working.
He goes, okay, kicking the pants, now.
I can really work with something.
Right.
You know, when things are going well, you don't really need a champion jockey. You need a champion jockey when the horse stumbles.
Right.
And I think that's when Vince McMahon really enjoys things.
I think you're right on that. And, you know, it's funny. We're both kind of from the old school era, and there used to be these guys. They were called the policemen in the territory. The guys that would take care of business. If someone needed a attitude check, the policeman would come in. Basically, the tough guys. You and Ron could be the last policeman I've ever seen because there was a few times in the WWE when guys would come in and guys would beat them down. Now, was this? I remember Public Enemy being one case, and the other one was the Invasion angle when they had the kids coming in. Was it Jindrak and O'Hare and those guys? Were you told by Vince to go out there and...
No, no, we weren't told at all. But now the Public Enemy deal was a complete separate deal. Right. That was those guys that showed up at 5:30 that day. They didn't want to put us over. Mm-hmm. And then right when the music was playing, they literally came to us and said, we're not doing the finish. And they said, we're not going through the table. And I said, that's the finish.
You're supposed to put them through the table.
We're supposed to put them through a table for the finish. We're literally at Gorilla, position right before you go out of the curtain with Jerry Briscoe, the only one in the room. And saying to us, we're not doing the finish.
Mm.
And I said, what do you guys want to do? He said, we'll call it out there. So me and Ron think, my God, man, we're walking into a fist fight. And I don't know what they had planned. Don't to this day. You know, we went out there and, you know, took them to task pretty good. And put them, you know, and I remember turning to Ron. Ron goes, what was that about? And he said, they said they don't want to go to the table. Ron said, we'll take the table to them. And that was all. And that was how that whole thing happened with Public Enemy. It was a matter of them not wanting to do a job.
Which is amazing to think about that, huh?
Yeah, and I don't know why. We sat in the meeting with them. It was me and Ron and I think Terry Taylor and somebody else and Public Enemy and went over the table spot. And they argued it a little bit, but not much. They didn't bring it up until the music was playing, about to walk out to the match.
Right.
And so Briscoe comes running to us and says, what in the world is going on? I said, I don't know. He goes, are you guys going over? I said, yeah, but I don't know if it's going to be 10 seconds or 10 minutes. I said, and he goes, you guys got to do the right thing. You guys got to go over. And so we had no idea what to expect. You know, we thought they would probably fight back a lot more, but they didn't.
Yeah. Did they go through the table?
Oh, yeah. They did all the stuff. And afterwards, we waited there for them, and they came through and shook our hands, said thank you. And
that was it. Yeah.
Yeah. Same. None of it was – there wasn't a
How wasn't about a the problem. Invasion thing? I remember in the Garden, those guys got a little bit of a beat down from the
Yeah, and that was just us being working hard. I mean, that was nothing. We worked the same way with the Dudleys, and we liked the Dudleys. That was nothing.
Yeah.
That was nothing out of the ordinary. That was just us working hard. And it was not – there was no animosity. There was no maliciousness. There was nothing. People ask us about that angle all the time because a lot of people saw the backstage promos that we'd cut as, you know, shoot with quotation marks promos. They weren't sheep promos. Mm-hmm. You know, most of the times those guys were there in the dressing room.
Sure.
There was no maliciousness in there with the WCW.
It was just the new kids
angle.
In town. And
it was the new kids, and we worked hard with them. We had to work stiff with them because we were working, I think it was in the Garden. Mm-hmm. We did the same thing with the Dudleys. I remember the first time Bubba Dudley tells the story all the time. He's going to hit us with a 2x4, and he had never worked a 2x4. And Ron goes, well, can't you work a 2x4? Bubba said, of course. He hit me so hard, my hands went numb, my fingers went numb, my feet went numb. And, you know, we gave him a receipt afterwards, and we were best friends, you know, from that point forward.
Well, we had the same when you and I worked. It's like, don't break my nose, don't knock out my teeth, and the rest is right. Just make it work.
And those guys with WCW Angle, those guys were great to work with. O'Hare and Jindrak, Plumbo, those guys. Those guys, we enjoyed working with them. You know, and they worked with us the same way we worked with them. That was a time where people... especially in the spot that APA was in, worked a lot stiffer than, you know, Sheamus does this now.
Yes.
Oh, my God.
And Del Rio. Yeah, those guys are strong style. That's exactly right. So let's talk about when you reinvented yourself with the JBL character, which by far the most successful run that you've had, and went from, kind of like me, went from a guy who was working in the mid-higher card to becoming a world champion and the top heel in the game. were you injured and came back with this, or how did the JBL character come into fruition?
Yeah, I was supposed to get a main event run, and I tore a bicep, and I was off for quite some
time. That's right. That's when we had the split Raw and SmackDown.
That's right.
Right.
Yeah. And so I really thought my career was over. And as I was training to come back, I had a double hernia. I had two hernia operations. So I really starting to think my career was over. And I'm getting my upper 30s, which after all the injuries I'd had in football and wrestling, I'm starting to think maybe this is it.
Mm-hmm.
And Stephanie called me one day and said, "We want you to cut your hair." And I said, "Well, I want to cut it anyway." And so I cut my hair. And literally, as my hair has all been cut off, she calls me back. She goes, "John, we decided not to cut your hair." I'm sitting there. I go, "Oh my God." I said, "Really?" She goes, "No, I'm just ribbing. Where are you at?" I'm actually in the barber's chair. You couldn't have planned this any better. And so I cut the hair, and I'd had in mind to be this character for a long time. Vince hates this analogy of being a J.R. Ewing type character from the TV show Dallas, but that's how I saw the character. And that's how I'd always pitched this character. But I was doing a lot with the troops overseas, and I don't really think they didn't need me. And plus, they didn't want me necessarily to be a heel. But at the same time, Brock Lesnar left the company. Big Show was hurt. Kurt Angle was hurt. You had so many guys out, and they needed somebody for Eddie Guerrero in 6 weeks. And so literally, I went from being nothing on the card to you're going to be in the main event for the world title in 6 weeks in LA. And so that's when the JBL character got created and put on the burner. And if it had been anybody but Eddie, that'd have been the only pay-per-view I'd have ever done. I don't think I would have ever main evented another pay-per-view, but I had the right guy at the right time. And we did the heart attack angle with his mother El Paso.
Wow. Forgot about that.
We didn't have a huge undercard that day. We were scared we couldn't sell any tickets. We actually set the attendance record at the time for the Staples Center. And it was 99% Hispanic, so they weren't there to see JBL, except JBL to get beat.
Yeah.
But we did the heart attack angle with his mother in El Paso on Mother's Day weekend, and that's when the angle just took fire and really got over. If it had been anybody but Eddie, that would have been probably the only pay-per-view I would have ever main evented.
You know, and he's been gone now for almost 10 years, and you know, the legend of Eddie lives on, but how good was Eddie Guerrero?
He was phenomenal.
Yeah.
I mean, just phenomenal. I'd go out there with him. That match we had in the Staples Center, there was a bloodbath. And
that's when he hit a vein or something.
Oh, my God. I've never seen so much blood. And Eddie, right before the match, Pat Patterson talked to us, and I could tell Eddie didn't like it. And when Pat left, I said, "Eddie, is something wrong?" He goes, "I don't feel that." I said, "Well, what do you feel?" And he goes, "I don't feel that." He goes, "I'd like to go out there and see what the crowd wants." And so I pulled Pat back in, and Pat was great. And I said, "Pat, Eddie wants to go out there and call it." And Pat said, "It's your match. If you think you can do that," he said, "go out there and see what you got." We didn't even have a finish. We had on a pay-per-view where we had to go 30, 40 minutes and didn't even have a finish.
Wow.
Eddie was that good. And he was taking bumps on tables. He was doing all this crazy stuff. All of that was called 100% on the fly. We go out there every night. He would just want to feel.
How exhilarating is that to know that you're live without a net?
Oh, it's unbelievable.
You know?
I remember one time I was standing by the announce table, and he said, "Backdrop me." I had no idea what he's talking about. And here he comes running. I go, "Jesus, he wants me to backdrop him through the table." None of this was called. None of it. I'm getting this huge backdrop. He lands on the table and goes sailing over there. I'm going, "This guy's really good."
Yeah.
This guy's awesome.
And great size differential. You know, the smaller, like you said, hometown Mexican guy.
We were wrestling in Japan one time, and I got the old Japanese mindset of be stiff, keep coming, keep coming, keep coming. And the match didn't work. And I couldn't figure out why. Eddie called me at 3 o'clock in the morning. He goes, "You didn't beg, S.A." And I said, "What?" He goes, "You didn't work JBL tonight." He goes, "You were kick-ass Stan Hansen." He goes, "Be JBL tomorrow." Next night, I'm on my butt begging, and the crowd is booing, and which I didn't think they would do in Japan. And the match worked.
Yeah.
But that was the perception of Eddie.
Sure, sure.
I remember one time we followed Undertaker, and he had an incredible match. I don't know who he wrestled with, but incredible match. I said, "Eddie, what the hell are we going to do?" I said, "That match was awesome." And he worked about 45 minutes on a live event, a house show. And he goes, "I don't know." He goes, "We're going to figure it out." So I get out there. He says, "Grab a headlock." So I grabbed a headlock. I said, "Okay, we used to do an arm drag spot." He goes, "No, no, no, sit here." And I said, "Eddie, how about we do the arm drag spot?" He goes, "No, sit here, Essie." Then I realized what he's doing. He's boring them. You know, it's something that's the 101 psychology. But you don't realize it. So I sat there in the headlock, and people went from this incredible high of the Undertaker. Then they go down. Then they almost get bored. Then all of a sudden we start doing stuff and start building them back up. And by the time we were done, they're all on their feet again, cheering. But we could have never kept them on their feet, not for 30 minutes.
Yeah.
You know, but that was the brilliance. You know, I got out there and panicked. And I thought, my God, let's start off fist and fire and beating each other up, going through tables. And he said, no, bore them. Just bore them.
Because
it was perfect.
You couldn't have kept that vibe going no matter what you did from the match before.
No matter what. Like, and so said, we brought them down and then started slowly building them back up. And at the end, we had them all at the end. And I came back and said, Eddie, that was brilliant.
Yeah, that's great, man. And you mentioned if it wasn't for Eddie that you wouldn't have stayed this character, wouldn't have gotten over. But the JBL character got over huge for a couple years.
JBL character had an incredible run, which was awesome because I didn't expect it. Mm-hmm. You know, so it came so late in my career that I really thought my time was done, that I never was going to have that main event push.
Right.
And since it came so late, I really enjoyed it. And I really just had a lot of fun with it. I mean, the matches I had with The Undertaker and the matches with Big Show getting choke slammed through the ring and all that different stuff.
Cena, the good ones. Yeah.
We had a lot of fun. I loved the JBL character. It was so much fun to play.
And then you went away for a while because I remember when I came back in 07, you were just coming back too because we started off a program together. Was your health, did you have a bad back? Was that bugging you?
I broke my back in a match in London, England. I was wrestling in a triple threat with Kurt Angle and Chris Benoit and just somehow got hit funny and broke my upper back.
Wow.
And I already had a herniated disc in my lower back, and because I was trying to take bumps and not hurt my upper back,
protect yourself.
I hurt my lower back worse, and it got where I had to retire. And then I retired quick. I was wrestling Ray on a pay-per-view in Phoenix, and the doctor's note came back and said, you got to get out of the ring now. And so on Monday Night Raw, I did an I Quit match with Ray, impromptu, but that was because all of a sudden my career was over.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't really ready for my career to be over. I didn't want it to end like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I worked hard to get back in shape. A doctor cleared me. Then I came back. That's when we wrestled, and then my back slowly got worse again. And so that year at WrestleMania, I knew it was my last match.
It was your finish.
Which actually, people have told me, don't you want a better match than 23 seconds with Rey Mysterio? I said, no, that's how JBL should go out. I mean, JBL was a whining, cry little baby.
Yeah.
He should get beaten 23 seconds and quit.
Yes.
You know, he bragged he's going to do something historic. He's going to do all this stuff. Plus, against his nemesis, Ray, which I picked Ray because of the association with Eddie. I said, you're going to retire me twice, Ray. This is going to be awesome. And so I couldn't wrestle a full match that time. I was too hurt. I couldn't have done anymore. And so I actually wanted to do it in 3 seconds. And for some reason, Vince wanted the comeback in the match, which is fine.
Yeah.
So that's what we did.
Amazing how like you said, how you're able to do that. But you mentioned too, like, you've done a lot of things in the business here, not just in the ring. You mentioned the troops. Now, you were one of the guys, if not the guy, that kind of brought the whole Tribute of the Troops thing to life with the WWE. Is that correct?
Yeah. Well, I was in when I tore my bicep, I went all around the world promoting the Xbox, and I was somewhere down in South Africa, and they called me, WWE did, and got hold of me and said, hey, we need somebody to go to Afghanistan. We had just invaded Afghanistan. So I was the first civilian group to grow into Afghanistan. And then later I went to Iraq, and that's when I came up with the idea. I said, wouldn't it be great if we did something like a Bob Hope USO type special? And so when I came back, I got with Vince and Kevin Dunn, and I said, hey, how about we do something like the old Bob Hope USO special? And those guys bid on it like, like a big fat guy to pizza. And I can make a lot of jokes here about that. But they loved it. And they said, well, yeah, work out a one-pager for us. So I worked out a one-pager for us. And from there, they took it and created Tribute to the Troops. So it was my idea. The implementation, though, all the nuts and bolts belongs to the WWE. They love to give me credit for it, but it was literally just my
Vince
idea.
Vince doesn't like taking credit for stuff like
he
that.
He hates taking credit for anything.
Yeah, anything where it's good. Yeah,
anything where it's good. Nice, he'll take credit for when something's bad, but not when it's good.
Those were one of the best experiences of my career going over there. We went 3 times, and what an amazing, amazing time to be over there. I mean,
It was an incredible time to see those guys and see how much pride they have. And
yeah.
You know, no matter what you think of, you know, their job they were doing, whether they're defending the country or not, should have been there. They believed they were defending the country, and they were very proud of what they were doing.
And so happy to see us, too. You know, like, thank you so much for coming. These guys are there for
The one thing
months.
We did, and I talked to Vince and Kevin about, was we don't want to go just to the green zone. We want to go to everywhere the soldiers are. Mm-hmm. So we split up and went places that no other civilians
outside the wire went. It's called.
That's
outside
right.
The
we go to all
zone.
The forward operating bases, all the special ops bases. I mean, mm-hmm. we went all over the country that most celebrities that go in there, some would actually stay in Kuwait, come into Iraq, do a photo op, do a concert, and fly right back to Kuwait,
yeah.
not even stay the night. You know, we were there living with the soldiers, doing everything they did.
Like you said, going to the unsecured war zones.
Yeah.
I remember one time we went outside the wire, and this was called Tarmia, and Ron was there. And we landed, and we had to take off running through smoke, and there was fires, and there was like, you know,
I was
carcasses.
With you.
You were the student, right?
With, yeah.
That's right. Remember that?
Yeah.
We got stuck in an
unsecured. There were dead dogs everywhere. Remember
dead
that?
Dogs everywhere.
Because dogs are rabid there, and so they had to shoot them because they gave away the position.
That's right.
So when we land, there's like smoke bombs going off, but I don't know there's smoke bombs.
I know me neither.
There are smoke bombs in case of snipers in the area, but all I see are bombs going off and smoke coming up.
We're running. They're like, go. We're running. Like, and I remember Ron. I was like, damn, I would have just mailed him a picture.
Yeah.
Because we're signing pictures. But I never forgot. I forgot that you were there.
I was there. Yeah. I was right with Ron. I was right behind Ron running. And remember, we didn't know we were going into a hot zone.
No.
I mean, we just flew in.
We just thought we were going to the place where we just do a signing for the base.
Because this was after the surge, so most places were safe as they could be. We fly into this hot zone, and we see dead dogs everywhere, bombs going off, which are our own bombs, but we don't know
that. To protect us from snipers, like you said.
To protect us from snipers, but we don't know they're our own bombs. All we know is things are going boom.
I know.
And smoke's everywhere.
And I remember that we got stuck there because when the helicopter landed, it got caught on some metal or something.
It clipped a pole coming in.
Right. So our chopper was disarmed. So we were stuck there. Yeah. And there was rumors that we might have to stay overnight. And this is like, stay low, stay inside, because there still might be, you know, insurgents, as they called them.
I remember when the colonel said, guys, we may take a convoy. And I said, sir, if I could have a vote. I'm going to wait on the helicopter.
And I remember the weights that they had were just like gas cans filled with water.
That's right.
Taped to a pole. You know, it was just, you could just, there was no showers there.
No shower, no running water, no hot water, nothing. It was really rudimentary.
And they were there for like 18 weeks in this like broken down old school community center. I remember there was spider webs in the corner.
And they were all scared to death for us.
Yeah. And we were scared to death
for us too. Yeah. Funny you say that. So were we.
Yeah. And they gave us the meals, the MREs or whatever they called the meals. And it was like, you want tuna or beef? Like,
right.
They're like, I don't know.
It all tastes the same.
Tasted like cardboard, man. Yeah. It was so bad. But man, talk about just learning respect for those guys completely, you know?
Yeah.
How do you like being an announcer now in the WWE?
I love it. Absolutely love it. When I left the second time, all the announcers' jobs were full, and I'd done commentary once before. Mm-hmm. When I got hurt before and had to retire, Vince called me up right away, or Kevin, I can't remember who.
Yeah, yeah.
And said, hey, would you come back and do commentary? I said, I'd love to try it. And I came back and I did it with Michael Cole on SmackDown. Well, then when I left the next time, Booker T was doing SmackDown, who's a good friend of mine, and King was doing Raw, who's a good friend of mine. Mm-hmm. So even if I was qualified to take their job, I'm not going to ask for their job. And so I was off for probably 2 years or so. I don't know exactly the time, 2 or 3 years, something like that.
You've made more comebacks than I have.
And then, that's right, I make more comebacks than Brett Favre. And I did the induction speech for Ron. Mm-hmm. And afterwards, I think I was talking to Kevin Dunn or something. I said, hey, I'd like to come back and reserve a spot. And then Booker moved to the general manager job. And so I called Kevin, Dunn, I believe it was, said, hey, I'd love to come back if you're interested. He said, actually, we'd like for you to come back. And then King had the heart attack right about the same time. So thanks to King dying on air, I got to
That's
come back.
That's what it takes, man, right?
Yeah, and I enjoy it. I mean, I enjoy being around the business. I mean, this is what all I've ever really wanted to do is be in this business. Mm-hmm. I really enjoy it. I enjoy coming to work. I enjoy the meetings that we go through that some people gripe about. I enjoy them.
The camaraderie, too.
I enjoy the camaraderie. I enjoy the art of commentary, of trying to be a heel but yet put over the baby face in a heel way, or trying to help some characters that need help. You know, the big ones, you know, after Al Michaels said, do you believe in miracles, he laid out. You know, and that's what you do in a lot of great matches. You know, you don't – you try not to crowd them. Now – people get mad at us sometimes. We have so much to cover on Raw. So a lot of times their interest is we're trying to cover business. You know, we've got so many things coming
up. Pay the bills,
We have to do so many things. But the big stars don't need help. Mm-hmm. You know, they just need you to stay out of the way. The smaller stars at times need help for education, for people to help. And I really enjoy that part of it.
Well, you're talking about helping, too, and there's a whole other side that's very interesting to me. You mentioned earlier talking about living in Bermuda now, and you moved out there to coach kids
How and why Bermuda of all places? You're just a small town Texas boy, man.
Yeah, we had my wife and I gone there on our honeymoon. We'd gone there several times. When I first had to retire, I'd traveled my entire adult life. And she said, why don't you spend the summer in Bermuda and I'll fly back and forth from New York.
Mm-hmm.
I said, that's a great idea. I love that. And then a house came open for us to rent right there on a golf course that I enjoy playing, Mid-Ocean Course. And I'd done some work with Beyond Sport, an international sport for change out of London. And I'd seen a lot of problems with the gangs and the at-risk kids in the school districts with things I'd seen elsewhere in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And so I brought in a bunch of gang experts from Rio, from Venezuela, from Chicago, from New York, from London, to put together a curriculum that we would go after these kids that were at risk. And we needed something. So rugby's our sport. And the reason is rugby, you can play 5-on-5. You just need a ball.
Right.
Or 15-on-15, whatever. It's not expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And plus it gets the kids' aggression out. So we put this program in about 3.5 years ago. We had, somebody told me, 113 kids last year in our program.
Mm-hmm.
There's about a 50% black Bermudian male dropout rate. Same as inner cities in North America. And most years we have 100% of our kids graduating.
Wow.
So and all of our kids are in the at-risk category. So we're doing a lot to keep the kids, to give them options.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're not as good at job placement and college placement yet. That's something we need to build.
Mm-hmm.
But the main thing is to keep them in school, because if they ever drop out of high school, you've lost them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the biggest focus we have right now.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I just got done today watching our kids down the Caribbean Championship play, and they won their first game against Trinidad.
And this is rugby?
This is rugby, yeah. Man.
Now, is that what led you to start climbing mountains?
Yes. Yeah. Well, when I first retired, my back was so bad I couldn't even walk, and it got better over time.
How did you get it better?
It just losing weight. Went from probably over 300 to about 245, 250 now.
Yeah.
And just time. I think really think time. So I don't know if, you know, more time is going to get worse again. I have no idea what the future holds. But it started getting better, and I always loved Sir Edmund Hillary as a kid in Mount Everest. And I ran into Annabella Bond, who had climbed the Seven Summits for a charity.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, man, that's the way I could raise money for my kids. And I always had this fascination with big mountains. And I'll go climb the Seven Summits for my kids. And so that's what I've done the last few years, is I booked one big mountain a year, raise a lot of money around it, and let the kids follow me on GPS and all this different stuff, and I'm using it to raise money for our kids.
Now, how many have you done so far?
I've done 3.
So how dangerous is this? I remember there was a couple times when you said you had to give up because the weather was coming. Like, could you, like, fall off the side of the mountain and die? Is it that dangerous?
Yeah, you know, most of the mountains, so we get to the big ones. We had 2 guys in our camp die on Aconcagua.
Wow.
We got caught in a
storm. 2 guys that you were with?
Not what we were with, but in our camp.
Wow.
So we had, I think, 6 or 8 of us in our group. There were 2 other guys, both those guys. One was never found. One was, our group found him right by the path.
How did they get lost? They fall?
Don't know.
Or
they were 20-something thousand feet. I think they went altitude crazy is what I think.
What does that mean?
Altitude affects you in different ways. And I'll give you an example. First time I was at 20,000 feet, I looked down at my backpack and I realized I don't know how to buckle it. And I buckled this thing 500 times. And I tell the guy next to me, I said, don't be alarmed, but I've got problems. I said, I don't know how to buckle my backpack. He goes, oh, my God. He goes, your mind's going on you. And I said, yeah, something's wrong. And he said, well, let's get you to camp and see what happens in a couple hours. And it all came back to me. You know, but sometimes it doesn't.
From loss of air?
From loss of air, yeah.
Wow.
You react differently to altitude at different times. And that's the worst by far. I've had it.
Mm-hmm.
But some guys, you know, you have sleepless nights. But, you know, sometimes actually guys will actually go crazy with altitude. And they also have HACE, high altitude cerebral edema, which is fatal.
Wow.
Your brain swells is what it is.
Wow. So how do you train for that?
You can't train for altitude. You just have to acclimatize to it. That's why it takes 60 days to climb Mount Everest. You know, you go through the Khumbu Icefall, you go up to Camp 2, you stay, you come back down, you spend 45 days climbing up and down this mountain, getting yourself acclimatized to it. Because if you get out at 29,000 feet, which is the peak of Everest, out of an airplane, you die in about 5 or 6 minutes.
Mm.
But you can, because you acclimatize, you can get used to
it. I got you.
And get up there and get back down.
It's similar to diving, right? You can't just go to the bottom of the ocean. You got to go slowly and adjust with the pressure and everything.
Right.
Wow. So how long did, what's the longest journey that you've had? Like how long?
I've been 18 days on a mountain down in South America.
Wow.
My next few mountains are not near as bad. Denali will be about 3 weeks. And Everest, I've got booked in 5 years, and that'll be 60-something days. So
you've got hopefully, you have to book ahead 5 years
well,
ahead?
Well, I say booked. I've tentatively told people I want to go on a guide.
Wow.
So I don't have it officially booked, but I've told the people I'm going in the year I'm going with the guide group. So I'm pretty much set.
That's amazing, man. Like you said, you wanted to be Edmund Hillary when you were a kid. You did that. WWE world champion. I remember you did a couple times you went running with the Bulls in Spain.
Ran with the Bulls in Spain. I had a fat guy outrun me the whole way. I did. I had one guy. I got down there at 8 o'clock in the morning, and that's one of the scariest things I've done because you have no control.
So the Bull just gets let loose in the streets.
Oh, my God,
and runs,
yeah.
And everyone's
got
to avoid
You're
it.
You're at San Cristobal, which is where most people are, and then the Bulls make that huge turn where they go sliding into the walls. That's San Fermin. That's about 300 yards up. You want to start there so you make it into to the arena, which is full of people at 8 o'clock in the morning. They lose six bulls and six steers. And so I got there early. I slept as much as I could the night before. Nothing to drink, nothing. I'm stretching. I'm in tennis shoes. Some big fat guy walks out in jeans and boots out of a bar. He's from Houston, Texas. And he outran me the entire way. He's going, come on, Big John. Come on, Big John. And the Bulls pass us. They hit one guy that was pretty close to me. Didn't hurt him, but you know, knocked him way up in the air and threw him for a loop.
So that's just total thrill seeking.
It's just total potluck. Yeah, I got down there. I saw a guy get gored horribly the day before, and I thought, you know what? This is just potluck. There's no strategy to it. There's certain places you can't be on the curves. But other than that, it's just potluck. And so once I got there, I thought, I've got to do it now. And then they lock you in, and they won't let you out. So once you get in, they won't let you out. The crowd will push you back in. So you've got to run.
And you've paid to do this?
No. It's free. You just show up. You don't sign a waiver, nothing. You just run. And all of a sudden, you hear the bulls coming from behind you. The crowd's roaring, and you're going, oh, my God. I mean, it could easily be me as the guy next to me.
Wow.
It's just total thrill-seeking. I would recommend anybody go down there and watch it. I think it's great to watch. I wouldn't recommend necessarily people running at it.
Last question, man. It's kind of a hard one, but what's your favorite match that you've had if you had to choose just one?
I've had some people ask that, and I've actually thought about this some. You know, it's hard to say. Mm-hmm. I've gotten to work with nearly all the major stars of my generation, which was awesome. I had a match in Meadowlands with Undertaker that was really a violent, violent match, which is the kind of match I liked. The I Quit match with John Cena I thought was a very good match. The match with Eddie, especially the first one, was
Staples
something
Center.
Special. Yeah, so it's hard for me to say because I really had some matches that, you know, I don't know if the fans enjoyed any of them. If you ask a fan what was JBL's greatest match, they might tell you none.
The 23-second
retirement match where I did nothing but take a 619. But there were a lot that I enjoyed, and I enjoyed working with all of them. You know, I enjoyed getting to work with you finally when I came back. I had the same luck with Shawn Michaels.
That's right.
I had not run a program with Shawn Michaels, so you and Shawn were two of the biggest stars of my generation, and I'd never gotten to work really either with either of you.
Yeah.
And I got to do a great program with you and then a great program with Shawn right after that, right before I got to retire. So for me, coming back for just those two programs was worth every bit of it because that pretty much cemented everything I
and
got
I remember,
to do.
And I remember we had some really good matches just on road shows. I remember Vienna, Austria, for some reason, that sticks in my head. We had just a really cool match there. And, you know, you don't forget those ones because people talk about the ones that are on TV, but sometimes it's the one that aren't on TV that you remember too.
Yeah, I had a match one time down in Mexico for WWE, and I just remember walking through the curtain saying, that's the best I could ever do.
Yeah.
And it sticks in my head, you know.
Yeah.
And the next night, it wasn't near as good. The night before, it wasn't near as good. But for some reason, that night, it just worked.
Worst match, Tiger Jeet Singh Jr.?
Oh, my God, by far. In Corican Hall. Yeah. It was horrible. We had a match, and his father came to me and said, listen, we don't do any of this Hulk Hogan BS. This is not WWF. This is all real. And I thought, oh, my God, this guy's going to be coming after me. So I get out there in Corican Hall. I hope I'm saying it right. I'm from Texas. So, and I took over the first part of the match because I thought, I may not get any of this. He was a big kid.
Mm-hmm.
So then I tell him, come back. There was nothing left in the tank. He was completely blown up. But, oh, my God. I took the entire match. We went home just out of the blue. It was horrible. You could have heard crickets. Went, oh, my God, I just got fired.
I don't remember why I remember that. I remember you telling me about that
it
back in 94 on the bus, and I always laugh at that.
And his father had scared me so bad about, hey, this is not WWE. And I'm looking at this big young man next to me. I'm going, Jesus, this guy's going to be coming like freaking.
Turban and everything.
He's
going to
be coming like Brody at me. I've got to gird my loins for this one.
John, man, thank you so much for doing
thank
this with
you,
me, man.
It's
been
pleasure.
Great, man. Very, very cool. And we got to go to work. We got Raw tonight, but always a pleasure, man.
Thank you very much.
Thanks to John Bradshaw Layfield. Great, great guy. Super funny. Good to have him on the show, and a really good-hearted guy as well. He's got a big heart and a big head as well. I've always noticed that. And thanks to Peter Thomas Fornatale. I appreciate him coming on down on the show to talk about my third New York Times best-selling book. So many plugs today. Also plugged, shout out to my man, Jim Ross, host of the Ross Report, also available at podcast1.com. He's doing the play-by-play commentary on Wrestle Kingdom 9 pay-per-view on January 4th. You might want to go check that out as well. You can download it on the Flips TV app and watch it on the smartphone or on the tablet, and you can find it on pay-per-view. You go to globalforestwrestling.com for all the details. Hear Jim Ross commentate some wrestling again. Going to be really, really cool. It's also cool for all of you guys doing your shopping through my Amazon links. I appreciate it. Easiest way to support the show so I can keep doing this for you for free for twice a week. You know how to find the Amazon links, podcast1.com. You click on the Keep Our Podcast Free banner at the top of the page. Then you click on Talk is Jericho. You see all three of my Amazon links, UK, USA, Canada, A. Every time you do that, Amazon kicks back a little cash to the show. So we can keep doing this for you for free for twice a week. No extra fees or hidden challenges. You're getting your shopping done. You help me out in the process. I appreciate that. I appreciate January 25th. Bischoff versus Pritchard Monday Night Wars debate with Jericho moderating. RFvideo.com for all tickets. That's January 25th, 1 p.m. at Dave and Buster's in Philadelphia. Gives you plenty of time to check it out. Then go see the Royal Rumble. Go watch the Royal Rumble. And in Tampa this Sunday, January 4th, Drags to Riches, Christian and Jericho together again playing bingo with drag queens. It's at Hamburger Mary's in Ybor City. This is a great, great time. Trust me, it is so much fun. That starts at 5 p.m. Come on down. It's for a good cause. Horses for Healing program at Quantum Leap Farms. We use this program. We believe in Quantum Leap Farms. We want to put on a fundraiser. It's free to the public. You can win prizes too. Just come on down, eat some hamburgers, play some bingo, and bug Christian. It's always fun to get under his skin. I know I'll be there doing the same. All right, guys. Happy New Year. Thank you so much for joining me. This is going to be the biggest 2015 ever for all of us. We're going to follow our dreams. We're going to make it happen. It's going to be the greatest year of our lives. I won't tee it. But in the meantime and in between time, that's it. Another episode of Talk is Jericho. Stay hard, stay hungry. Peace, love, and hugs. We'll see you next week. And I got one of the biggest guests ever on Talk is Jericho. Yeah. Who do you think it is? I'll give you a clue. The biggest wrestling superstar of all time. Worldwide for a number of years. There's been peaks and valleys with other guys, but this is the man. You think of wrestling to this day, you think of one person. That's right. The Hulkster, the immortal one. Hulk Hogan will be on Talk is Jericho next week with two huge shows to officially kick off 2015. And what you gonna do, brother, when Hulk Hogan and Talk is Jericho run wild on you? Yeah, boy, brother.
You can download new episodes of Talk is Jericho every Wednesday and Friday at podcast1.com. That's podcastone.com.